So let's get started. Sorry, I was not paying attention to the time. Can you guys all hear me?
No.
Not really well.
Oh, can't hear you.
Okay, how about now? I just turned up. Okay. All right. So one more before winter break. Roll call, and then we can.
Abramovitz.
Here.
Allman. Barnes.
Here.
Berge. Anyone here for Anna Berge? Bret Hart.
Here.
Cassio.
Mara Bachlacher, all set.
Thank you, Mara. Cherry.
Here.
Kaufman.
Here.
Cook.
Here.
Anyone here for Mark Condi? Atur is here. Thank you. Dean.
Here.
DeStefano.
Here.
Duke. Rob Duke. Fallon, Gibson, Hank,
here,
Hardy,
I'm here for Hardy.
Okay, I heard a voice.
Over here.
Oh, okay, for Anna, thank you. Hartman,
here.
Healy,
here.
Hornig. Thank you. Horstman.
Yep.
Johnson.
Here.
Jolly.
Here.
Lon.
Here.
Larden.
Here.
Lawler.
Here.
Lovecraft.
Present.
Mahoney.
Here.
Thank you. Maxwell.
Here.
McCartney.
Here.
McDonald.
Here.
Meyer. No, Franz Meyer. Misra.
Here.
Moser.
Here.
Newberry.
Here.
Peterson.
Here.
Radenbaugh?
Yes, here.
Thank you. Rice?
Here.
Shallcross?
Here.
Gaia?
He'll be here.
Thank you. Valentine?
Here.
Weber?
Here.
Wildfuhr? Winfrey? Kathy Winfrey, Tim Wilson for United Academics, our registrar, Libby Eddy, is here. Do we have anyone from ASUAF? Okay, I think Chris will join us. Anyone from ASUAF? Did I just say that? Danny is traveling for athletics. Paul Lair. And Lair is here. We have Susan Henrich, and the chancellor is traveling.
He may try to call in.
Okay. Okay. We have our vice provost, Alex Fitz. Great. Thank you.
Okay, great. I'd like to approve the minutes. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second.
Any objections? Okay, minutes are approved. What's the agenda? Everybody okay with the agenda?
Moved to approve.
Second.
Okay, it's approved.
So the agenda looks a little light today, but I have a feeling that we're going to fill up the time with at least two topics that are fairly likely to spark discussion. But we'll get to that in a minute. There are no motions pending, and I really don't have much to say today. I really want to leave the time for a lot of your questions and the discussions on the topics. Libby Eddy reminded me that my brain is not functioning. What was due again? Libby, tell me. It'll come to me. If it comes back to me, I'll tell you.
I could use this opportunity to let you know that UA Online will be down on Monday morning from 4 to about 10 or 11 in the morning. That is after grades are due. It is the 29th.
Oh, UA Online will be down just for a day?
Just for about 4 hours.
Okay.
And then keep it to four to 6 hours.
Okay, and then maybe this would be a good time for a reminder for, was Blackboard going to be down too? Or was it just UA Online?
I don't know about that, but I could send a message out.
Okay, all right. Okay. Yeah, other than that, you know, I mean, a lot of things I wanted to address will be my presentation on the alliance, the relationship between the alliance and the Senate per request last time. So I will not say anything more about that and hand it over to the next person.
Okay, so all I have to say is that this is a great opportunity, end of the year. I would like to thank each and every one of you for your contributions to the betterment of UAF. And all the committee members, committee chairs have done a super job. I would like to really thank all of you for your attention, for your deliberation. The second thing is we are coming very close to the to the holidays, so I'll wish you all happy holidays. Stay safe, and the rest of the semester, enjoy it as much as you can, and we'll see you in February. Thank you.
Well, the reason that the chancellor is out of town is he's attending the inauguration of the new governor. He was also a member of the governor's transition team, along with Vice Chancellor Mike Sprague and Vice Chancellor Yvonne Peter. So the university had a good bit of representation there. In addition, as you probably have heard, but if anyone has not, Vice Chancellor Pitney has been tapped to be the governor's budget director, director of the Office of Management and Budget for the governor. And Mark Myers will be the new Commissioner of Natural Resources, Vice Chancellor of Research. Now, Vice Chancellor Pitney has already departed. Vice Chancellor Myers will not be departing until January. But it's clear that the university is going to have a lot of knowledgeable people in the governor's staff group, and that it will be it will give us an opportunity to make good points about our value to the state and the need for the university to remain strong, even through the state's budget challenges. The chancellor may choose to talk more about those in his remarks, so I won't go into a lot of detail. One fact that the chancellor brought back from his service on the transition team that I found very striking and not particularly cheering in this holiday season is that the state of Alaska is currently running about a 50% budget deficit. That is a budget deficit expenditures relative to revenues, where we have a $6 billion roughly total state budget. But only $3 million in revenues this fiscal year. That clearly is going to bring both the governor and the legislature to the conclusion that state spending needs to be reduced. We yet have no specific information on how that's going to be accomplished, but the state cannot keep spending beyond its means for very long. Right now, the state is relying on reserve accounts that were filled when oil prices were high, but at this rate, those reserve accounts will only last for about another 2.5 years. The university system as a whole, but UAF in particular, is already planning for revenue, state revenue reductions, and the special program review process is part of that. And I want to leave a few minutes anyway for people to ask questions about the special academic program review process, or to the extent that I'm familiar about with other special program reviews that are ongoing under the supervision of the Chancellor's Office. To answer a few questions up front, the academic programs that were chosen for special program review by the Planning and Budget Committee were chosen predominantly on enrollment and graduation-based statistics. The Planning and Budget Committee did not consider issues in detail like centrality to the university's mission. And those issues, however, will be considered, and they will be considered by the normal program review committees during that process. So those issues won't be ignored. They were not considered by the Planning and Budget Committee because the Planning and Budget Committee did not feel that it had enough information or enough expertise to make those kinds of decisions. Another question that gets asked of me quite a bit is the plan to eliminate all of the programs on the special program review list? No. The decisions will be made on the merits of the program, but keep in mind that we are in a very severe budget situation, and there must be some cuts somewhere. Those are being considered across the university, not just with academic programs, but also with research programs, with various administrative services and facilities issues, with some of our support services like marketing and communications and so on. So there's not a focus for the cuts on academic programs by any means at all. In fact, in a relative sense, less is of academic programs than is being expected of other areas of the university. But nonetheless, we don't have the luxury of not considering where the university can make cuts if that proves to be necessary with what we're allocated from the state. So with that, I'll stop speaking, and if people have any specific questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Will Pitney and Meyer's jobs be subject to the 90-day freeze?
In terms of being refilled with permanent individuals, or as long as people normally hold those positions, I guess permanent isn't quite the right word, there certainly will be more than a 90-day delay, because in each case, I believe, although I'm not 100% certain, because I haven't spoken to the Chancellor about the VCIS position, but I know for certain that the VCR position is going to be the subject of a national search. So there will be that delay in hiring. Now, there will be interims appointed very shortly, so there won't be a delay in the sense that there'll be an interim appointment of somebody who's already a UAF employee.
And since I don't see any hands, let us ask a follow-up question. Is there a plan, and the Chancellor's town hall meeting didn't really answer, well, actually didn't answer this at all, so I don't know if you know or with him I need to consult, but is there any plan for review of the vice chancellors or the administration following any kind of fashion that the special programs review is looking at academic and other research at the university?
I'm not aware of any plan specifically to review vice chancellor positions. There is and has been an ongoing process of review of all administrative functions that's been carried out under the administration of the VCR. You can see the results of that on the OMB website. Overall, there has been a reduction in both senior and not senior lower level administrative positions over the past 5 years. That's been partly a process of intentional review and partly just ad hoc individual decisions not to refill positions.
But those reviews were taken within management itself, right? There was no faculty or other external to administration participants in that review?
That would be correct. Most of those reviews were conducted by teams that were established by the Vice Chancellor for Administrative Services. So I'd encourage you to go ahead and if you wish, ask the Chancellor that question directly. Or if you want to ask me to ask him that question, I would do that.
Yeah, I have a question about the review of academic programs, which is a general question. I was wondering, so if you have a master's degree or something or other, and you decide not to offer that program, if you still employ all the faculty, how much of a savings would you actually accrue from doing that? Is it enough to really make it worthwhile?
You're correct that if we eliminate a program and continue to retain all the faculty that formerly taught that program, that we will not experience a lot of savings. In the specific example, say there was a master's program and a baccalaureate in a given department, we decided to eliminate the master's program. If there were no faculty positions eliminated, the most we would probably save is by shifting the workload of faculty to teach undergraduate courses instead of graduate courses and thus eliminating some adjuncts or something minor like that. However, there are a couple of other ways it could go depending on the severity of our budget situation. And I would not look forward to doing this, but again, we live in very difficult financial times. If there were any untenured faculty in the department, there would be the potential of non-retaining them because, of course, there would be now more faculty workload available because they would no longer be teaching the graduate courses. Another possibility, a little less draconian, would be that at the next retirement, no faculty would be hired to replace because, again, there would be fewer workload units being assigned to the teaching of graduate courses.
I'm still wondering about the timeline for the special academic program reviews, particularly now since we're about to embark on Christmas break.
The timeline is very difficult. The Chancellor has asked for at least preliminary assessments from the. We'll have the faculty committee convened in early December, as in very soon. He has asked for at least some preliminary feedback from that faculty committee in mid-January that, as you say, may be difficult to achieve with the Christmas break intervening. But my instructions have been to do whatever I can to facilitate that. I can't imagine being able to fully complete the program review through the administrative committee and the chancellor's cabinet any sooner than February, about the end of February. So there'll be some additional time there.
So will membership of these various committees be made public?
They won't be secret. Like all the program review committees, they will be posted on the planning and budget or the OMB website. So the faculty committee charged with special academic program review has not yet quite been constituted. We're waiting for final appointments from one or two deans, but when it is, that information will be available.
I just want to add a comment here. As you probably know, I've served on the Planning and Budget Committee in the spring and again this fall. And I can really say that I have been impressed with everybody's willingness to put everything on the table and to consider really all possibilities. And I mean, and I've said this before, there isn't anything particularly appealing. You know, there is no low-hanging fruit. There are no easy options. There weren't in the spring, and there certainly aren't now. There isn't with the program review. There isn't with anything else. But the people who have been on this committee have been have refrained from advocating for their own units, which I find incredibly impressive. Which, you know, it's an easy thing to do when you're sitting in the room. People have really refrained from doing that. People have been really open to really trying to understand all of the different options. Getting more information is necessary, and just really trying to look at each possibility from multiple perspectives. And again, this is sort of something I feel that I can be proud of as a representative of that committee. We've really taken great care to not let the heaviest burden fall on those in either the lowest ranks in the university, whether it's staff or faculty, and that's hard to avoid. But to not have a disproportionate burden on those who would be hit hardest, but to really consider how to sort of spread the pain, I suppose you could say, in more even ways. And again, sometimes that's really hard to avoid. As the provost just said, when it comes to, for example, cutting back on faculty positions, of course it is people who are not tenured yet or who have temporary contracts who are the most vulnerable, and that's hard to change. But the committee has been very very conscious of those repercussions and has been very mindful of them in formulating recommendations.
How are the committee being mindful? I mean, you know, if faculty positions get cut, it's entirely possible that term-funded faculty will go first. How is the committee being mindful of that?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a piece I don't know what, you know, I don't know how to address that, and there really isn't a good solution for it. But, for example, I can give you another example. One of the options, there were a number of options sort of in the personnel management category, things like furloughs, going to a 37.5-hour work week, which is kind of a furlough in some ways, and various options like that. And we really examined what the intended and unintended consequences of those types of recommendations would be, especially on the lower level earners.
I'll just add that it's unavoidable, according to university's policies and also the union contracts, that term faculty would be more vulnerable to layoffs than tenured faculty or tenure-line faculty. But to address Jane's question more directly, one way in which the committee tried to be even-handed was not targeting CRCD programs, which are far more populated by term faculty than by tenured faculty. They were considered on the same criteria and the same basis as other programs and are not disproportionately represented in the special program review process. I'm just not seeing any more questions, so maybe we can move on. People are free to email me or make an appointment to discuss issues if they wish.
And as the provost said, we're hoping the chancellor can join us. He will most likely, if he can, phone in during the second hour. So hopefully we'll hear from him as well. Okay, so let's move on to governance reports. Chris, I just saw you
walk in. Perfect timing.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity to share. Chris Becks, UAS Staff Council. I really just have one thing in this relatively short month for us, too, which is we last week submitted some suggested changes to the draft regulations for the tobacco-free policy. And with that, in part, our resolution, as well as the one that this body passed, the biggest suggestion we made is to have designated smoking areas on campus, on UA campuses, period. That was last week, so we've heard nothing yet, but as of this morning. Other than that, yeah, we're involved in planning a budget committee, just like you guys are, and have concerns there as well. As well as the draft regulations for the proposed furlough policy, which is currently with General Counsel. Our committee that worked on that has kind of finished the first part of that. So we're awaiting that to hear back from General Counsel regarding that. And that's really it. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Anybody got questions for Chris? Okay, in that case, let's move on to AQAF. Okay. All right, Danny Shepard couldn't make it today. Tim, you want to talk about United Academics?
Nothing to report this time.
Okay. And then how about Jane?
UAFC is still in negotiations, and I'll report on the Joint Healthcare Committee if I could. So we met with Blue Cross in November, and for the first quarter, healthcare costs across the university remain down just a little bit or fairly flat. The majority of our pharmacy spend is being spent on specialty drugs, and that trend is expected to continue. I want to remind members of our health plan to use the appeal process if you're denied a claim. Apparently this is happening quite a bit, but if you use the appeal process, many claims are coming through then. And also remember that the wellness program date began November 1st, it goes to April 1st, and it includes a look back for biometrics to July 1st. That's where you get the $600 rebate. So,
question for Jane.
Okay, so has the JHCC discussed about how this budget situation will impact healthcare next year?
No.
And Jane, I wanted to thank you for continuing to serve on that committee. It's so important to us. So thanks for your work. I know that's it's a very time-consuming one.
Okay, so we're ready for our guest speakers. Our favorite topic, parking. are all three of you going to come up? Nope. You generally don't fight.
You know, I figured this would be the most depressing part of this meeting, but apparently after the budget discussion, I'm actually walking into a pretty good
Not even close.
My name is Raj Kurapati. I work in financial services. Today we're going to be talking about UAF parking and some recommendations that have come out of the last round of PBC discussions, which happened in the spring. Some recommendations that came out of it on what actions we've taken to date on it. I'm also joined by Amanda Wall, who is the director of our Office of Bursar, and parking actually reports to her now. And also Martin Klein, who is a business manager with facilities. Martin also helps co-manage parking, and primarily on the facility side of the operation. So I'm going to try to get through this, and as I stumble along, Martin and Amanda will jump up and pick me up. With that, you should have copies of the presentation in front of you. So I'll go through this pretty quickly, and we'll leave enough time for questions. Can everybody hear me okay? If I stand up? Yes? And then we can talk about any specific concerns and questions you may have. So this is the FY14 parking revenue. We thought we'd start with providing a sort of an overview of what the parking revenues look like and parking expenses look like, and then kind of walk into some of the actions we've already taken, and then some of the additional actions we're recommending. And then what we're going to do is take feedback from everybody. We've already made this presentation to Cabinet. We also made this presentation to Staff Council and the Provost Council. And we intend to, of course, speak with you folks today and with ASUAF. And then we'll gather input on the recommendations that we're proposing. And then based on the feedback we get, and I'll share some of the feedback we've already received as well in this PowerPoint, we'll take some decisions back to the Chancellor's Cabinet, and we'll implement what seems to be the least what seems to meet the least amount of resistance, wherever practical. So the FY14 parking revenue is approximately $1.83 million generated. Most of it is majority of it, of course, coming from regular permits, the transportation fee, producing about 7%, meters producing about 9%, citations as well producing about 9%. Day permits are essentially departmental permits, which are permits that departments pay to have reserve spots and/or have special permits. So, obviously, the permits are the biggest source of revenue. Expenditures for FY14, the biggest piece of the pie goes to shuttle operations. Parking includes shuttle operations because we can't really sort of separate the two because they kind of complement each other. The other big costs include parking salaries and wages for the people that actually manage that, and also electrical and maintenance of the parking lot. So it's obvious that, you know, the revenues in FY14 didn't quite meet the total expenses. We actually we had approximately $100,000+ deficit in FY14. And I'll share a little bit more about some of the subsidies we had to do to keep parking whole. So this actually is a historical fund deficit summary because, parking has always operated in a deficit for some of the reasons I'll share further in this presentation. So in FY08, there was a subsidy, and essentially we were at a break-even point at that point. And since then, we've consistently incurred deficits in the parking financials. By 2012, we had an accumulated deficit of approximately $500,000, a little over $500,000. So in FY13 and 14, we had to provide operating subsidies to parking just so they can continue to operate. Provided a subsidy of about $250,000. Needless to say, in our funding environment in FY15 and going forward, continuing to provide subsidies to parking or any other operation for that matter is not a luxury that we can afford to do. So we have to do something to fix the current fiscal operations of parking services. Recognizing this, even before the PBC recommendations came about, we started taking some actions internally. One of the things that we did was to move parking from facilities over to financial services. And as part of that transition, we looked for ways to reduce costs and also reduce personnel. And we focused primarily on the personnel on the administration side of parking. So essentially, as a result of the official transition of parking to the office of the bursar under financial services from facilities, we were able to eliminate about 3 FTEs for a total savings of about $187,000. Had we not done that, the financial picture in FY14 would have been much bleaker. We would have actually incurred an additional deficit of close to $250,000. So this was primarily on the administrative side of parking. In addition to that, we moved parking enforcement to UAF police. It made no sense anymore for us to have a dedicated staff of parking personnel doing citations when we could use our community officers to do that for us. And as a result of that transition, we were able to also realize a net savings of about $15,000. As minimal as that may sound, it actually adds up over time. So we did quite a bit on the administrative side of it, but there are costs that continue to rise in spite of these adjustments. Obviously, the fixed costs. The first one being shuttle costs. The maintenance costs, that's the cost of clearing the lots and keeping them clean and ready for use. and of course, electrical costs. So we actually see the trend line. You can see there's some anomalies, but majority of the time, the costs continue to increase, and there's nothing that says that they would go the other way. Well, perhaps with oil prices the way they are, they may actually come down a bit in a 515, but the natural trend is that fixed costs continue to increase. So given that, we had to take some actions, additional actions immediately to sustain partners. So one of the actions we took is to eliminate the TALCO service. TALCO service is the one that's in circle. Has the least amount of ridership. We eliminated that particular service, and as a result, we expect to realize annual savings of about $105,000 a year. And I think I missed one slide. In addition to that, one of the recommendations we are putting forth is to eliminate the summer shuttle service as well. That is, as you can tell on this slide, that is the second least utilized shuttle service that we provide. That would actually result in additional savings of about $40,000 to $80,000, of course, because half of the savings will only accrue in FY15, with the full savings accruing in FY16 and beyond. So if we did that, then that would result in about $80,000 a year beginning in FY16. And we also will have some level of service as well, because a student-run electric bus will go into operation, we expect, in summer 2015. So that should actually provide some service, and will, of course, provide on-call service for folks with disabilities to ensure that they have the appropriate transportation that they will need.
Raj, can I ask you, what does student-run mean in this?
The Office of Sustainability, and Martin can help me here, the Office of Sustainability has purchased a vehicle in an effort to promote a more sustainable use of energy sources to run parking. And the student-run shuttle service, you can see, if Martin can speak to that.
So, yeah, that bus is on
the port. Okay, can you speak in the mic? Yeah.
The bus on the top is on order and should arrive this spring. It was actually originally scheduled to arrive last fall, and it got held up by the manufacturer. As far as student wants,
can you just speak in the microphone?
In the microphone.
Okay. As far as student run, we're planning on using students to drive the bus in the summer, and primarily that route will go from Wood Center to Westridge and back. That's really the only service that we would have operating this summer. So that's what we want people to understand. This is a proposed change, and that is the effect if we do that. There would not be shuttle service, for example, from Eielson to or from Wood Center to the Nenana lot or from Taku.
Another recommendation, actually I should point out that the PBEC recommended in the spring that we look for ways to cut an additional $200,000 from shuttle operations, which is partially what's driving this, in addition to obviously the bleak outlook for parking services in general, financially. Recommendation two, we're also recommending that we significantly reduce off-campus shuttle service. We've actually implemented pieces of this with full implementation to happen of the recommendations, assuming that we take all of them to happen over the course of the fiscal year. Basically, no longer on demand, replaced with limited fixed routes from Wood Center, focusing on peak demand times. We also intend to focus our services to areas where they're actually offering classes, obviously the old University Park and the like. We've also substantially eliminated or reduced off-campus service. This is expected to result in savings of about $35,000 to $50,000 a year when we fully implement it.
Raj, I have a quick question on this one, please.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So basically, the services in the evenings and nights, what I understand from students is basically for safety reasons.
I'm sorry.
For safety reasons, you know.
Yes.
Some students want a bus service so that they can safely reach a place that they want to reach. Now, by eliminating some of the services, have the safety factor been factored in into that?
Yes, we have. In fact, we got, I don't know if for those that attended the Chancellor's Forum last week. You know, but that was one of the things that came up in that discussion. So we're certainly taking notes and taking those recommendations and concerns. No final decisions have been made on most of these. So that would be part of the sort of the review process, and we'll make sure that, you know, for safety reasons, if you know, a police escort is necessary for some students and the like, you know, we'll look at different options to ensure that those concerns are addressed. So in spite of all these changes, as I shared earlier, costs continue to rise, revenues are remaining constant or going down, and as a result, just making cost adjustments resolve the issue. As I had noted earlier, we have been incurring about $200,000 to $250,000 in annual deficits, and even though we make significant changes on the expense side of it, if we don't do something about the revenue side of it as well, we will be back at this juncture in a relatively short period of time. So in addition to making the cost reductions that I've discussed, we're making some recommendations on also the revenue enhancements. So one of the first recommendations is look at the transportation fee and propose that we increase that at $2 per year for the next 3 years. That actually is expected to result in $9,500 in revenue a year, and over the course of the 3 years compounds to about $28,500 a year. The transportation fee is currently set at $13 per semester, and is paid by the students, and it has changed, remained unchanged since implementation. I believe that implementation was over a decade ago, I want to say. So it's obviously there's been no adjustment to that, and there have been, you know, obviously cost increases over that course of time. The second recommendation we are putting forth is looking at parking permits and looking at some sort of adjustment upwards on the parking prices. And the recommendation we put forth was looking at a 3% increase per year for the next 3 years. That's expected to result in about $33,500 in revenue annually, compounding to about $100,000 over the course of the 3 years and onwards. The third recommendation we're putting forth is to look at our daily meter prices and change those from change them to 75 cents an hour or $5 per day. Right now the prices are at 50 cents an hour and $3 a day. That actually results in a significant amount of revenue, and that's $10,500 a year estimated. So going forward, that would complement our revenue picture. And finally, one of the things that we're toying with is looking at zone parking. And essentially what that is sort of looking at different types of right now we have gold lots and then we have regular lots. We're actually looking at zone parking that would actually be three-tiered at least, and look at those at the closest proximity to our buildings as being the highest price, with those that are a little further out being medium price, and then the outliers or those furthest removed being the cheapest. I'll share some of the input that we've gotten on that, and thus far there hasn't been I'll finish this thought and I'll take the question. There hasn't been huge support for that as of based on the input we've received thus far. Question.
So for the zone parking, would that get rid of the gold lots and things?
Right.
And be able to see the three zones?
Right. So Martin, if you could come up and speak about the zone parking real quick, the idea.
We're getting rid of these services.
I guess the best way I could summarize zone parking was there was a push to say, can we make cheaper remote lots on campus that are further out? And in the process of doing that, we said, well, where would those really be? The three circles you see on the map are the three that we said, well, these could be more remote lots. They could be cheaper. And Jane, your question, in a sense, gold lots don't really go away. They still exist under there. They just become the higher tier, and then the middle level becomes the middle tier. This is an idea, it's a concept, and I guess what we want to stress is this is not something that would happen quickly. We know this is a real devil's in the details, kind of working this all out. So we're asking for feedback on that. But one of the other push that we've had from a lot of people asking, and it's also very controversial, is why don't we have any gold lots on West Ridge? So under this zone plan, we're looking at the possibility of making either Arctic Health East or possibly the lot to the north of Murray a gold lot, too. So, or a higher price lot, yeah, let me rephrase that under this. So this is the idea. What Raj hasn't got to in this presentation is at the end we have a feedback mechanism on this, and there's a survey, so we do want to hear feedback on it. But go ahead.
Well, in particular with regards to Murray, I mean, that was specifically dedicated to be a student-oriented building for the sciences, and now you make it impossible for the students to actually go there.
And that's exactly the kind of feedback we're asking. So what we're saying, I want to stress, this is an idea that we put out there, and we're asking for feedback back on it. But I think at this presentation, I want you to understand the concept that we're putting out, a zone-type concept. And what I hear you saying, which is not, as Raj will point out, is not uncommon. We've had a lot of negatives about this. And the question we really want answered, though, is what do you think of the zone as a whole, not specifically? I hear you saying that Murray is not a good lot, but the real question I'd like to hear back from you, and we would, is do you think the zone concept as a whole is something we should pursue if we could get out of these deals, or you think, no, what we have is okay the way we're at, or is there something else?
Well, first of all, I have a question for you, and then, you know, the answer to your question about the zoning, it's a terrible idea because, again, we are student-oriented. We are here for the students, you know, and now you're making them third-class citizens by parking somewhere outside. It's awful. But the other question that I had is, so that one of the zones there is the Taku and the Nenana lot, and you just proposed to get rid of those shuttle services.
Right.
So how is that supposed to work?
So that does make it basically the challenge with this. And when we looked at this, we said if we're going to realistically implement zones and we have cheaper remote lots, we would have to have some sort of shuttle service. And so when we started looking at what our savings would be, we assumed that if we implemented zones, we'd have to bring back some level of shuttle service from those remote lots.
But first of all, a lot. But the other thing that you fail to forget, I think, is that we are in Fairbanks. And most of the time, this is not an easy thing, in particular in the winter, to just, you know, hike up the hill.
Right.
Well, okay, can I remind you that people on this side of campus have been hiking up the hill for decades?
Well, I'm not that. That's fine, but I don't think that's an option for everybody.
So again, I'll point out again that we'll be sharing some of the feedback that we got on this, and this is the kind of feedback we're looking for. No decisions have been made on zone parking. These are some of the options that we're considering. Now, obviously, if that turns out to be something that we can implement and not stay true to some of the things that you pointed out, then obviously we won't do it. So again, we're looking for feedback to see whether or not this is something that's even, you know, even something that we can implement. Yeah, please.
So I just want to make an observation first, which is I find this map a little bit unhelpful because it doesn't have B and C lots indicated, and I think for feedback I'd like to know who's A, who's B, and who's C.
Right. Again, we have not sort of fully thought this idea through.
I know, and that's the devil's in the details, of course. But it is ironic that the Murray lot you're suggesting would be a C, and then it's right next to a remote lot, which is A. Sort of undermines the geographic proximity argument a tiny bit. But that's a minor point. I'll just say one thing. I mean, I'm totally for zone parking. I think it's a great idea.
So just to clarify down at the bottom, the current gold lots, which are indicated on the map, what would be C lots, and some lots on West Ridge, which we haven't really sorted out.
Right. But can you see the gold lots right now on there?
Yes.
Color-coded?
And I'm colorblind, but I'll point.
They got hash marks.
So we have very few gold lots, as you can tell. There was one more question here, I think.
Yeah, what you've got here, in my opinion, for many faculty, simply compounds an issue. When you're talking about zone, you already have a zone when you have gold and non-gold, right? I mean, I don't see a whole lot of difference other than for the gold, you're going to make them really pricey gold. And right now, one of the problems you have is called discrimination based on where you work. But if you work in certain areas, you pay out of the you-know-what.
Yep.
And if you work in other areas, you pay normal fees, and you park closer maybe than even people that park in gold lots. You are doing nothing to eliminate this type of thing, and you're simply expanding it. I have a problem with that kind of this people who have to pay for gold because the option otherwise is so far away, and let the people that have buildings or have parking lots really close get off even easier.
Okay. I just got a note. The chancellor's on the line. What I would like to maybe propose is Rorick's had his hand up for a while, right? You had a question?
Yeah, really
wait, quick. Hold on before you get going. Is to let you ask your question, for you guys to reply, and then we should get the chancellor on the speaker so we can listen to his comments. And I don't know how much time you have. We could get back to you.
Oh, yeah.
Or
we can certainly stop at any time you feel it appropriate, and then we can resume.
Okay.
Just a quick question. I think it was based on this earlier comment. I'm not sure. It wasn't clear to me. Why does zone parking eliminate students, discriminate against students? I missed how that happened.
I think the suggestion was that students wouldn't be able to afford the larger,
the
more expensive ones, and as such,
$50 a year.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you want to stop now, or do you want to continue?
If we could stop now.
Sure.
Possibilities for input are on the website, correct?
Yep.
On the parking office website.
Yes. The actual PowerPoint is actually also posted on the Office of the Bursar's website, and there's a link actually in this PowerPoint. If you look into your handouts in the PowerPoint, there's actually a link to the website as well, and we are seeking input. So on each of the options, there are actually questions and a survey that you can respond to as well. And if you feel strongly about a particular one or not, please share that, and we'll compile all this information. Again, we're actually received quite a bit of input from our previous presentations, and we'll continue to compile the information, and then we'll make some recommendations further and take actions based on that.
Okay. Now, I just want to encourage you not to get lost in the weeds at this point. These are, as Roger Martin has said, these are ideas, concepts at this point. And don't forget, business as usual is not an option. We, one way or another, we have to raise some revenue, so somebody's going to have to pay some more money.
But it shouldn't be the students.
No, agreed, but let's not get lost in the weeds on this. There are options of dealing with that. So provide feedback on the website, and I would like to thank Raj and Martin and Amanda for coming today.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, so is it okay if we wait with a break until we've had a chance to talk with the chancellor?
Yes.
Okay, all right, so let's do that. He's already there.
Thank you, and I appreciate your patience, and I'm a little bit late getting to the meeting today. I'm in Juneau for tomorrow's meeting of the University of Alaska Foundation Board of Trustees. Came a day early so I could attend the governor's swearing-in ceremony, and just came from there. As we're all aware, we have a new governor effective noon today, and he comes in with a fiscal challenge that is far greater than we thought it would be even just a month ago. I guess the good news, if there is any, is that he's got one of the best people, if not the best in the state, to address the budget challenges, having drafted Pat Pitney from UAF to be the new director of the Office of Management and Budget, and with the new commissioner of Natural Resources, Mark Myers has taken 40% of the vice chancellors at UAF. I think one person noted that at least he knows where to go to find quality staff. I told him and his transition team today that two is enough. The transition process will roll out over while now as they pick the commissioners and other key staff. But for us at the university, there are really two actions that I think are most important. One is the governor's action on the budget, and the second is the governor's appointments to the Board of Regents. On the budget, what we've been told so far is that the Governor Walker will be introducing the outgoing budget prepared by former Governor Parnell, and that will be presented on the statutory deadline of December 15. And then over the course of the next 2 months, as Governor Walker and his staff make their decisions, they will submit amendments to the budget, and those are due according to law by the 15th of February. The fiscal news, as the price of oil has now dropped below $70, puts the state in about a 50% deficit. Fortunately, the state is sitting on substantial reserves, but at the current burn rate, those will be gone in just about 3 years. So I would anticipate additional budget actions will be taken, and we'll see some roll out over the coming couple of months, which really underscores the importance of the special program reviews, looking at a group of the support programs as recommended by the Planning and Budget Committee, and looking at the academic program review, the special program reviews there. It's clear we're going to be a smaller university than we are today, and the important issue is to ensure that it's not so much smaller that we don't survive and thrive as an institution. The Board of Regents appointments, there are four positions whose terms expire at the end of January. It's our hope that the governor will make his appointments to those four seats, which could be reappointments or could be new appointments, prior to the January Board of Regents retreat scheduled for the 22nd and 23rd of January. That'll give an opportunity for the new appointees to participate in that retreat, where I expect a lot of discussion about the budget issues. As I mentioned earlier, there are two vacancies at the vice chancellor level. I'm going to be talking about those with cabinet this afternoon. Given the 90-day freeze, my intent will be, after discussion with the cabinet this week, to appoint interims from within the university and to then search on both positions, but not fill them on a permanent basis until at least 90 days has passed, and it's quite likely to be a longer period than that. But we'll want to get permanent people in as rapidly as we can. I think any of you who worked with either Mark or Pat know how much they brought to the university and what their experience meant for us. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions or to hang on and listen to further discussion about parking, if that's your wish.
Are there questions for the chancellor? Yes, Amy.
Susan mentioned that the vice chancellor for research is going to be a nationwide search. Is that correct?
It will be an open search to candidates nationally, and I think that's always been our tradition for academic positions. I would note that there are several strong candidates from perspective within Alaska, within UAF, but I think we always have to be open to new ideas.
Are there comments or questions? Boy, this is a quiet bunch today.
Everybody's
shell-shocked.
You know, I think the fact that people are shell-shocked is not surprising. I know I am. I've been through challenging budget times before, how quickly the price of oil has fallen and how quickly it's reshaping our budget discussion is certainly alarming. But you know, many of us were here through the tough times in the mid-1980s and know that the university came back to thrive after that again, and I'm convinced that whatever the period of this trough is, that we will come back out the other side and be successful.
Chancellor, could you maybe talk a little bit about how the university can define itself for the future, to survive and thrive in the future? How, I know we've discussed that as part of the funding and budget committee, but maybe you could talk a little more about it.
I think that the ability to demonstrate that we add value to Alaska, to the fabric of life in Alaska, to the economy of life, to the culture and arts in Alaska, being out there is a key underpinning to being successful. It's one of the reasons that I continue to harp on making our case, telling our story, and connecting to the economy and culture of Alaska. If Alaskans care about us, we will thrive. If Alaskans don't care, we won't. Second, I think it is our shaping of the Arctic in the future. We have a key role in determining how Alaska will play in the Arctic and how our leadership affects the rest of the country as well. It's an area that we have defined ourselves, that we are out there and are recognized, and I think that that presence allows us to thrive in certain areas. So a combination of serving Alaska and serving the Arctic, to me, is the best place for us to be in order to thrive.
Would you like to add anything to that?
I'm sorry?
Cecile was just asking if I wanted to add anything. I don't have a smooth, prepared future vision, although the Planning and Budget Committee is working on that element, and will value faculty senate input on that when we get a little bit farther with the process. But I would add that I see a successful future that involves more interdisciplinary research and more collaboration in both research and academic areas. I think that this is something that UAF is already better at than any larger universities. Our smaller size puts us in closer proximity with our colleagues in other fields. And I think that we can distinguish ourselves by building upon that strength.
So, Chancellor, I have a question. This is David. So we have this mission. We have this mission lesson about shaping up the future. Now we have a project with the state. How are you going to find or going to be aligned?
I'm only hearing about half of every other word. If you could get closer to a microphone.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay. So the question was that we have this mission of shaping Alaska's future. That has been worked on diligently by the summit team for a long time now, 3 to 3 years at least. And now we have this sudden budget crisis, and how is that going to affect the mission of the university? Will we have to change, adapt, or is there something that has been planned?
Well, certainly as the Shaping Alaska's Future was developed, there was little thought about what a crash in oil prices
would bring. I think that the shaping themes and the objectives of shaping Alaska's future will inform the decisions that the Board of Regents makes as we move through the budget crisis. It may slow down our ability to deliver on some of the intended outcomes, but I don't think it will change the fact that those are still the intended outcomes.
And another question I have, when we say the university will be smaller than it is today, is this just about UAF, or is it all the three universities we are talking about?
I believe it's all three. What we've seen so far from both this president and the Board of Regents is that when there are reductions, they've been proportional across the three universities.
So we get the lion's share?
We get a larger share in dollar amounts of total reduction because we have the lion's share of the budget to start with.
Okay, other questions, thoughts? All right, I think we're ready for a break then, but thank you very much for phoning in. That was very helpful.
Thank you.
So 10 minutes, please. So if we could be back at 20 after. Okay, so today there's really only one item of new business, and that is curricular affairs, as usual.
Hi. This isn't going to cost anybody anything except for the time. Honestly, we'd like you to rubber stamp this one, but rather than just saying, hey, rubber stamp this, I'd like to provide you a little bit of background upon what we're asking and why we're asking for it. First of all, new minors have to go through several committees of approval, then the faculty senate, then they get signed off by the provost, the chancellor, and finally the president, but they don't go to the Board of Regents. So we can create as many minors as we like without the Board of Regents getting all upset about it. That's a good part. Secondly, in a sense, this is not really a new program, but rather it's sort of a reshuffling of what Natural Resources Management has done in the past. Julie Jolly, who's here from Natural Resources, has agreed to jump in whenever I say something foolish or stupid or incorrect, and I'm surprised she hasn't jumped in yet, but she's standing by, okay? So Natural Resources Management degree is unique among Bachelor of Science degrees in that it requires a minor in addition to the major requirements. It's also traditionally had several different concentration areas, one of which was forestry. Several faculty members left, causing the removal of that concentration area from the degree, and the compromise that was dreamed up was, okay, let's have a minor instead in forestry management that will still allow our students to get the training necessary for certification in forestry without major changes in the degree program. So no new courses are involved, no new faculty are involved, essentially simply a restructuring of how the degree is offered. The weirdness, so we're looking at the bottom of page 3 and the top of page 4 of your agenda today. they're separated, unfortunately, but that there it is. The first couple of paragraphs on the top of page 3 in the middle describe what it is that the program is trying to accomplish. The actual regulations for the minor are on the bottom of 3 and top of 4. The weird part about this, or the seemingly weird part about this, is the parenthetical statement, cannot count towards major, that shows up at the bottom of 3 and near the top of 4, cannot count towards major. The reason behind this peculiar language is that it's anticipated the bulk of students who would be taking on this minor would be students in natural resource management, and the intention is that they take prerequisite courses that are needed for forestry, but they take that as part of the major program, not as part of the minor. On the other hand, by having this minor, there's at least the possibility that students in an allied field, biology, for example, might decide to embark on this minor, in which case that whole business about not being used towards a major would be not applicable. In other words, the anticipation would be that there would be a handful of students in natural resources management that would embark on this minor that in previous years would have instead gone for the concentration in forestry. But it was decided that as long as they're doing this, let's make this thing so that it's open to students in other fields as well.
Well said.
With that said, we'd like you to approve this, please.
Question? Motion?
Just a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
But this isn't possible, maybe this isn't something that a person could just take a certificate in without getting a degree in any way. I mean, I know it's a minor, so it's not, but is it leading to that, the idea to, like, get certificates to people who may be wildland forest firefighters?
No, okay. This is
totally
definitely a full academic program. But the idea that this would teach you is an SAS certification for students to take pass. So if the students take all of the required courses and pass with the site awareness, they have to be certified courses.
That they would have to have all the other training,
exactly.
Including the minor, to get that.
Exactly.
Other questions? Okay, can I have a motion then?
So moved.
Okay, second? Any objections? Okay, motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to move myself over there now. Okay, but just to kind of do the preamble here, at the end of the last Senate meeting, there was a question about the role of Faculty Alliance in relation to the Faculty Senate at the three universities, and there just really wasn't time to go into that. But at the last ADCOM meeting, I was tasked with putting together a presentation to kind of give some context, give some information, an opportunity to ask questions. And so hopefully, I also have it, I have it on the jump drive so we can get that to work. Oh, there we go. Thank you. Okay, so again, I wanted to, you know, and this was not the most entertaining or elegant presentation because I was tasked with this not that long ago, and I didn't want to spend my whole weekend working on it. I'm sorry about that, but hopefully it will provide again some of the gaps in information and And I would also like to use this to kind of give some updates on what the Alliance is doing, using what we're doing as examples for various things. Okay, now my clicker isn't working. Could somebody advance, please? Oh, okay. So this is really hard to see. Sorry, this is a graphic that is on the UA governance website. And I will make this slideshow available as well. I'm going to explain a little bit what this is. So for those of you sitting further back, you don't need to see all the detail at this point. But what it shows is the relationship of the three main governance groups to the UA president and the Board of Regents. So we have the three pillars, the Faculty Alliance, the Staff Alliance, and the Coalition of Student Leaders, and their various memberships. Those three pillars are coordinated by the System Governance Council, which is the chair or president and either president-elect or vice-president, depending on what the titles are, of those three governance groups. And they meet two or three times a semester. The president has authority over UA regulations, so university-wide regulations. So the president can change regulations on his own. But the Board of Regents is in charge of UA policies, system-wide policies. So any policy change has to go through the Board of Regents. And this actually is important, as you will see in some of the examples. Okay, so this is kind of a similar thing. And again, this is on the governance website, and I will make the slides available as well. But again, this shows the three on the left, the three governance groups, their relationship to the system-wide governance group. So the three senates are represented by Faculty Alliance, the student government by the Coalition of Student Leaders, staff councils, staff alliance, and then again, sort of, they interact with each other and they interact with the president's office and the Board of Regents. System governance office at statewide coordinates but does not have an additional function, but it coordinates between the different governance groups. Okay, so this is an excerpt from university regulations. It is also part of the Constitution for Faculty Alliance, but it is in UA regulations. So can you just put them all on there? Yeah, that's it. So just describing how the university sees the role of shared governance, basically, is what that says. There are other articles before and after that, but this is really kind of the meat and potatoes. So the expectation by the Board of Regents and the President and their various offices are that there is shared governance and that there is respectful collaboration on various decisions. Okay? Okay, so again, there are various sort of defined purposes for the Faculty Alliance. And you can find those in the Constitution of the Alliance. And again, that is on the governance website. One of them is the most obvious representation of the three faculty senates, so the faculty leadership on the statewide level. The Alliance provides consultation to the UA Summit team, which is the three provosts, the three chancellors, the VP for Academic Affairs and Research, and the president, correct? Okay. And then the president and the Board of Regents.
And of course, and as we've experienced, it's a major information conduit between the different levels of governance. The Alliance, just like the Senate, have an advisory role rather than a policy decision-making role. So the Senate does pass policy, but it's always, as you know, it's advisory. It has to be approved by the Chancellor or the President or other levels of governance. And when issues have statewide importance or impact, and that's of course when the Alliance comes in. It doesn't deal with the issues related to just one university, one of the three universities. It always deals with issues that bridge the universities. So then, you know, there are tasks that have to do with coordination of matters relating to academic affairs. So like academic program review, that wouldn't be program review of a program at, let's say, UAF, but it might be a review of types of programs across the three universities. The same with any addition, deletion, merging, anything like that. It only is concerned with things that cross university lines. And again, it's advisory rather than a decision-making body. Okay, curriculum. And again, I mean, there's way too much text on these slides, and I didn't intend for you to have to read all of that now, but I do want that to be available. This is just, it's literally taken from UA regulations and the Alliance Constitution. But so it's a broad range of matters, very similar to the UAF Senate, but just really cutting across the three universities. You can skip that. This is just about how recommendations are transmitted, and the, you know, really the expectation is that anything that comes from Alliance to the President or the Board of Regents shows in some way that there was communication or collaboration or coordination in some way, and that all views were expressed are represented. And then on the other way, I just totally lost my train of thought. This, the only thing here is that okay, so if we bring something to the Board of Regents, the expectation is that the governance leaders are part of the discussion. And of course, David has, and maybe you can give an example of that, David?
I can think of a counterexample. In September, the UAA Faculty Senate passed a resolution asking the Board of Regents to reconsider some of what it had come out with in April, its April board meeting. And that was very poorly received by the Board of Regents because the Board of Regents viewed the one Faculty Senate coming up with a resolution like that as not going through channels. The channels being that, okay, so one Faculty Senate feels this way. What about the other two Faculty Senates? Do they care or not? So if things were done the way the Board of Regents envisions it and the President envisions it, the ideal thing, if we wanted to do something like this, would have been to have all three faculty senates pass a similar resolution, and then the Faculty Alliance take that resolution and say to the President, this is the sense of the faculty across the UA system, and then it would go into something like that. So it's rather a counterexample as opposed to an example of the way that you asked for it, but the first one that came to my mind.
Right, but I think the idea here is that if Faculty Alliance has an issue and it is deemed important enough to be on the agenda for the Board of Regents, then you as the Alliance chair would be part of the discussion of that issue.
Yes, my role would be to communicate that to the president and to the Board of Regents. Mm-hmm. And in the graphic that you showed earlier about the relationships, it sort of showed that everybody goes through the president, but actually the chair of the Faculty Alliance now actually interacts directly with the Board of Regents through its seat on the Academic and Student Affairs Committee.
Right, and that's new. And so you're right, that hasn't been updated in that graph. So that's a new development. Well, and we've always been able to bring things directly to the Board of Regents. But if it goes through the president's office in some way, you know, that's the sort of the usual route. Okay. Okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit about, because I think this is where most of the confusion is, kind of the workflow between the individual faculty senates and the Faculty Alliance. And that, of course, has become much more important because we've had and will have many more issues that concern all three universities in some fashion. Right now, and I looked at it again about a year ago. The Alliance revised its bylaws, but I took another look at exactly what both the Constitution and the bylaws say about how the Alliance works with the individual senates, and there really isn't anything in there. Everything that's in there is about how the Alliance communicates with the president's office and the Board of Regents, but doesn't directly address how to work with the individual senate. So I think that is something we'll have to address because, like I said, it's becoming much more common. But basically what happens is that an issue is brought either by one of the senates to the Alliance. One example of that was a recent one. It was a review of the student dispute resolution policies. UAA started a process of reviewing all of their policies related to this issue and wanted to know if the other campuses were going to do the same thing, and I believe UAS is actually looking at theirs as well. And so we brought that to the administrative committee of our Senate to say, okay, do we want to also have some systematic review of these policies? And it was indeed assigned to one of the Senate committees, Faculty Affairs. But so that would be one example of how an issue is brought up by one of the Senate to the Alliance to see if there's broader interest in addressing that particular issue. And then, of course, the other way around is there is an issue that starts with the Alliance or with the president's office or somebody at statewide saying, here's an issue, we want you to deal with that. And then it's dealt with at the Alliance first and then brought to the Senate. And those are the things that we're usually more familiar with. So one is the minimum admission standards, which was not a big deal here at UAF because we already had basically the standards that were being proposed, but has been a huge issue at the Alliance level because UAA has not agreed with them. Right? So this has become a much bigger issue in terms of having some standards that cut across the system because at least one of the institutions has a very different philosophy about that particular topic. So that hasn't been a big issue here. We haven't reported back to it because we passed those standards and we passed, in fact, a resolution saying, yeah, we endorse this. But it has not made it through the Anchorage Senate. David, do you want to say anything more about that, or is another example?
There's the common calendar issue that's being worked on. There's the three parts of the Regents resolution from last April concerning GER alignment. So
right. So that's the next bullet point. Yeah. So that those are things that came from higher up and are filtered through the Alliance to the Senate. But in all of those cases, they are first researched and discussed at the alliance level to see if we can come get on the same page even within that group. And again, sometimes that's not that hard to do, but sometimes it's really difficult. And sometimes it's in unexpected places like the minimum admission standard. Of course, the common GERs has been a big topic and will continue to be a big topic, although there it's been much easier to sort of work across campuses. I think mainly because the alliance doesn't have the job to come up with the specific recommendations of what changes to the GERs should be. And this is really important. The alliance is really a group that coordinates those kinds of efforts, as opposed to doing all of the nitty-gritty work on specific issues themselves. So with the GERs, that's a good example. David, you want to talk about the committee that was just formed?
There's actually been three that we've spun up this fall. The first was the first two had to do with math and English specifically. So we got together some cross-university faculty involving primarily department chairs of English and math that are now working to align the courses and cut scores and so forth that were called for in the Regents resolution of last April. The third group that we're just putting together now is a group that's working to address the rest of the Regents resolution concerning how do we get to a set of aligned GERs that's much broader. The region stated in their resolution their intent to make it a policy that the three universities would share a common GER. We wanted a faculty group to essentially work that issue across the three campuses to say how do we interpret aligned GERs to be of maximum value to our students? What would that structure look like? And then recommend all of these won't just simply happen. All of these are being coordinated by the Faculty Alliance, so we'll come back to the three faculty senates for consideration and passage once their work is complete.
And this is actually a perfect example of how of where the president's authority to change regulation is really important. David meets with the president regularly, and so of course one of the topics is the GERs and changes to them. And so there is most likely going to be a need to change UA regulation on general education requirements. And the president has indicated that he would be willing to accommodate regulations if we come up with a good plan for common GERs to change the regulations accordingly to make that happen, to smooth that path. So that's where so that would not have to go through the Board of Regents. And so that's really, really important because it makes some things much easier if there's a good working relationship with the president. Okay? So, and again, I mean, the importance of having members of the alliance come to some agreement is crucial because if the alliance can't even come to an agreement and something that has any chance of passing the three senates, basically the issue is dead on arrival. And so we need to get to a point, the alliance needs to get to a point where we can have a motion that we can take to our individual senates and have further vetting and discussion, but where it has a chance of being passed. So after the alliance has drafted a motion, they are sent to the individual senates where they are first vetted by either, in our case, it's the administrative committee or the executive committee, and then that committee decides whether that motion is ready for prime time on the Senate floor. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. So sometimes they're sent back and said, well, we don't think this is going to pass in our Senate. We see these numbers of issues, and they send it back to the alliance before it gets to the Senate floor. And then it gets revised. The alliance has to come to an agreement again. It comes back to the executive or ADCOM, the executive committees. And so that kind of goes back and forth until there's agreement that, again, this is good enough now to go to the Senate. Then it goes to the Senate floors. And then each Senate has to decide, of course, whether to pass that motion or send it back to the alliance. And so you can see that things that on the surface are fairly simple can take a long time, can go back and forth at various levels numerous times, and really require people to really keep an open mind and really think about not only what works at their own university, but what could potentially work across the system and still serve the needs of the local campus. And that has made things really, really complicated. And again, sometimes they're just really genuine differences in philosophy. Sometimes, you know, we, like everybody else, gets hung up on little stuff. But oftentimes they're really genuine differences in philosophy about education, about the role of a state university, particularly in Alaska. Yeah, David.
I'd like to just raise one point right now. I want to sort of remark that what Cecile is presenting us is not necessarily her or our vision of how things ought to work. This is simply how it does work. And if it sort of looks like it's kind of complicated and kind of cumbersome and involves multiple opportunities for failure, you're right. It does, exactly. One of the big challenges that universities have going forward is that there's increasing pressure on governance to be able to act more quickly within universities. And so a key challenge that the Alliance and the three faculty senates have to deal with is, how do we go about taking this current cobbled together kind of coordination thing and somehow make it more efficient, somehow make it work more quickly? You know, should the Alliance, I'm not saying this is necessarily the case, because I you know, this is not the purview of the Alliance to do, but should the Alliance become something like a conference committee that works between the Senate and the House to come up with a final version of things passed and actually have that power? I don't know. But if we were to go in that direction, that could conceivably save quite a bit of time with respect to this, although we may wind up with things come out of the Alliance that not every Senate agreed to. So I just wanted to kind of stick that
right
there.
Oh, exactly. And that's exactly what I've been thinking about a lot lately. And, you know, so one of the problems we have is, so what do we do if there's an issue that either none of the three universities can agree on, or two agree but one disagrees? What do we do then? So right now, there isn't a process laid out that helps us break that kind of a stalemate. And so again, I think that's something we're going to have to think about in terms of what David just said, of kind of just having to become more expedient and more efficient, but at the same time preserve the interest and input of the individual campuses. Okay, but I mean, that's basically what that last slide was, is what do we do when there is disagreement and there's no obvious solution? Or, you know, or if the Senate can't agree, you know, maybe that the Alliance comes to an agreement, but then no matter what we do, we cannot find a solution to a problem that can pass in all three Senates. What do we do then? Do we at some point have a rule that it's like, you know, 2 out of 3 majority vote kind of thing, or, you know? So we will definitely have to think about that, because, as I said before, we will have more and more issues that cut across the system. But I think that all of the members of the Alliance are keenly aware that that the universities want to preserve their own identity, and that we have unique issues, challenges, somewhat unique student bodies. We're all really, in the end, regional universities. You know, if we look at enrollment numbers, the vast majority of our students, whether it's in Fairbanks or Juneau or Anchorage, come from our region. So we're all distinctly regional universities. So, of course, you know, again, that brings sort of somewhat special challenges, issues, opportunities. So a lot of it is going to be about how do we balance sort of this sense of identity with having to come up with more and more solutions that cut across the system, that can be implemented across the system. And how can we do that without having to spend 2 or 3 years going back and forth between the various governance groups, because that's not going to be productive. And I think if we want to be constructive partners and want to be seen as effective partners, we need to start finding ways to do that more efficiently. David, you're about halfway through your term as chairing the Alliance. What are your thoughts on that, sitting in that chair?
I keep focusing on what you said about we're being increasingly asked to do these things. So I've been on the Alliance now for 3 years, and that's the term that everyone is on for. And this is by far the busiest of the 3 years of my involvement. We've spun up four committees, each of which had various degrees of gestation difficulties in getting going, but they're all spun up now. We'll all be seeing the results of their work starting in the spring, and you'll be seeing a lot more from the Alliance than you have in recent years, in the not too distant future. If anybody here finds yourself being elected president of the Faculty Senate, and one of you will at least, depending on what year you're elected, you wind up in the rotation for chairing the Faculty Alliance. But regardless of whether you're going to be chair or just a member of the Alliance, it's still a leadership role, and it's a challenging one. I'll just stop there for the moment.
Are we just having questions?
I have a question, and it's not a five-minute question, but isn't there some kind of elephant in the room related to the fact that we're the PhD-granting institution and system? I mean, it's always there, right? And so when you describe us as regional universities, on the one hand, I respect that, because clearly Alaska is huge, and we cover regions which then have certain sociocultural, linguistic, natural resource, environmental, social patterns, right, that the universities should be paying attention to. But I, on the other hand, right, I wonder how much cooperation I don't know, I'm just thinking, right, it's got to be an enormous delicate balance, because on the one hand we want to cooperate, but on the other hand, right, we should be looking out for ourselves. And I guess in this budget crisis, it seems to me that one of the major points that UAS should have is that UAF should be the institution of academic excellence, right? And that's signaled through the PhD granting capacity that we have, all the way down through hopefully what could become perhaps a much more enhanced honors program. But I don't know if you want to comment on that. It seems like in all this discussion, we don't ever mench that, right? You are a great mensch, but I mean we don't ever mention, right, this fact. And it I don't know, is it because we don't want to talk about it to the offense of UAA and UAS or what?
It comes up in a variety of ways. One of the coordinating bodies among the three universities that I don't think Cecilia actually mentioned was this statewide academic council, or maybe you did mention it, but
I didn't.
Okay, the statewide academic council consists right now of, it's chaired by the vice president for academic affairs and research, and it consists of the three provosts, three representatives from the Faculty Alliance, and now up until recently it was also vice chancellor of research from UAF and from UAA. And now recently, UAS was added to that device. Their essential research lead. Yeah. And in that conversation is you know, this is, and I can turn to Provost Hendricks for elaboration, but in the conversations at SAC about who should be on SAC and how does voting work, that all had to be worked out in deference to what the roles of the three universities were. So before, and I say this, Susan, without letting the cat too much out of the bag, before we were willing to say, okay, come on board, UA Southeast research person, we wanted to make sure that the structure of SAC was not such that everybody got an equal vote, but rather that it was done by consensus, and there was some conversation having to do with UAF as the research lead. So all I'm trying to say is that coordination, that kind of recognition takes place primarily, I would say, in SAC, less so, at least in my history, because of the kinds of issues that we've had less so in Faculty Alliance.
But I mean, I think you make a really good point, especially with respect to sort of finding the balance between representing the needs of our own institution and then the need to collaborate across the system. And I do feel that tension, definitely. And there are certainly issues where that comes more into play than others. From what I understand, in the 2 years that I've been on the Alliance, things have been sometimes hotly debated, but there was always a spirit of collaboration. But from what I understand, that hasn't always been the case. So I think, you know, depending on who's serving at the time or what the topics are, sometimes that can become fairly contentious. You know, right now people are pretty willing to keep an open mind, but I think everybody's aware that, you know, that we all have our own interests. And sort of, again, strangely enough, these minimum admission criteria, you know, sort of bring a lot of that to the forefront about who, you know, who gets to have a say over what, and what's more important, you know?
So, for example, with that, one of the key things that UAF sought to preserve with the baccalaureate requirements is that we, regardless of what is said at the statewide level, we want to reserve the right to have higher admission standards than the rest of the system. And so whatever comes out of Alliance work on revising university regulations concerning minimum baccalaureate standards, that language will be in there. And that's because of what we want.
Yeah.
This one's on here.
Thank you. David, you talked about committees being created by Faculty Alliance. Are you meaning a task force? Because the Constitution doesn't say anything about committees. It talks about a task force. Is that what you're meaning?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm
okay.
meaning. I'm sorry, sloppy language.
Okay. Then one of the things I've been uneasy about is if you go into Article 3, Item C, it black and white states that the Alliance shall have advisory and coordinating role in academic affairs. No action of the Alliance shall abridge the individual academic major, administrative unit's authority in academic matters. But then when you go down to the task force, it talks about the Alliance can establish task forces for these complex matters, but issues and suggestions of the task force from whatever source shall be referred to the local faculty senate before any formal action at the Alliance level. Could you address that? How, you know, quick, because it sounds like the Alliance and the task force are one, and they're working together. And from the Constitution, that's Article 4, Item F, it sounds like you establish a task force, and then it goes out to the individual senates, and then it'll go back to the Faculty Alliance for coordination.
I don't read it that way. Although that's close. The way that I read it is...
I quoted out of there. I wasn't
I know,
interpreting.
I
was quoting.
I know. But okay. what does final action mean? So final action, the way I interpret that is final action being conveying to the President and Board of Regents. That's what I take
right.
final
yeah.
action
right.
to be. So the way that this works with the task force is the task force's report back to the Alliance. The Alliance takes a report and recommends to the Faculty Senate any action that that comes out of the report.
Right.
The Faculty Senates take action on that,
exactly.
And then we take the action from the Faculty Senates and take that to the President and the Board of Regents.
Correct. That's how I understand it as well.
But you got to understand that that's not what it says here. Again, let me read. Issues and suggestions of the task force from whatever source shall be referred to local faculty senate before formal action. And it just sounds like it's going the opposite.
Formal action means, the way that I interpret that phrasing, formal action means adopting a coordinated response from the three faculty senates to the Board of Regents and the President.
Okay. Yeah. But it is okay to have a dissenting view there in the presentation to the Board of Regents.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, yes.
Because you made it sound like all three faculty senates have to agree.
No, but it may not serve our purposes if they don't agree. Then the Board of Regents might say, well, we asked you to solve this problem.
So if we come back to the
right.
Board of Regents and say, okay, we have a majority view and we have a minority view, we could do that.
That's simply according to the Constitution that the presenter, you in this case, would be required to present both the majority and minority
yes.
view.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Okay, we're over time. We have not had public comment period. Is there somebody from the public who would like to make a comment?
I realize people are leaving, so we'll make this quick. My name is Linda Hapsmith. I'm the director of the Academic Advising Center. We just want to announce that we'll be recruiting for three faculty advisors for Academic Advising Center for spring. The information about the application is on the back table there. It also includes the information of our rotation plan. We have a two-tier system for faculty advisors now, so this will be our beginning, our faculty advisor one position. And we are accepting applications from any college, but we are giving preferences to colleges and schools that aren't represented in our office right now. So it would be the School of Management, College of Rural and Community Development, College of Engineering and Mines, and College of Liberal Arts representing social science departments. And so the application form, it's a Google form. It's on our website at www.uaf.edu/advising. But the information, the requirements for the position, the knowledge, skills, and abilities are all listed on the handout. This, if you do apply, just keep in mind that you have to be approved by your department chair and your dean. This is an overload on your UNAC or UAFP contract. So it's $1,500 for a semester, a set price for that. So set price for buying you for $1,500. So that is the information about the application. If you have any questions, you can just let me know. Thanks,
Linda. Does that mean that you're only taking applications from people who passed their electronic advisor training?
No, we're accepting applications from any faculty member, but the expectation will be that you will complete the online faculty advisor training and FERPA training during the semester that you're hired.
So are those the only two things that allow a faculty member to become one of your advisors as opposed to doing it in their office?
Well, you'd still be a faculty advisor for your office. This is like an overload assignment. So we have a committee. That's why we're having an application process. We ask you to put in a CV, references.
Qualifications that a person has to pass to be available to take that job you're offering.
Yeah, just you have to be faculty. Preferences for tenured faculty, so you're not worried about dealing with that, and that you have at least 2 years of experience in higher education, preferably 1 year at UAF. That's all preferences. But there are other advising positions within Student Support Services that have slightly different requirements, and Ginny Redmond, the Director of Student Support Services, will be telling you about those.
Thank you, Linda.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Ginny Redmond. I'm the Director of Student Support Services here at UAF. And if you're unfamiliar with our program, we're a college retention and access program. We're part of the federal programs. It's a TRIO network. So you might have heard of Upward Bound or Talent Search, and we're related to those programs. So we look at it as our goal to help first-generation college students, students who are limited income, and students with disabilities graduate with bachelor's degrees. So as Linda mentioned, we are looking for faculty advisors for the spring semester, and we're looking in particular for faculty who work in a STEM field. We find that a lot of times our STEM students, so our science, technology, engineering, and math, have a little bit of a slower start getting connected with their departments and their faculty, and so we're really looking for faculty not only to help with registration and stuff like that, but to serve as a mentor and to model, you know, what somebody could do in those particular fields. So similar to Academic Advising Center, I have some brochures back on the table. You can also check out the job duties and then the rotation plan on our website, which is www.uaf.edu/sss, and then click on the faculty and staff resources link, and there's also a Google application on that website as well. So it's the same pay rate as Academic Advising Center. Specifically, we're looking for advisors in STEM, so pretty comparable qualifications as Academic Advising Center, except we prefer somebody who has experience in a STEM field. Are there any questions or anything I can answer?
Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you.
So I'm not sure we have a quorum to adjourn anymore. So we may be stuck.
Oh, no. Another month here.
Move to adjourn.
Second.
Okay. Can we agree to adjourn?
Yes.
Okay.
Adjourn.
Thank you.